No one would have believed, in the last years of the 19th century, that human affairs were being watched from the timeless worlds of space. No one could have dreamed we were being scrutinized as someone with a microscope studies creatures that swarm and multiply in a drop of water. Few men even considered the possibility of life on other planets. And yet, across the gulf of space, minds immeasurably superior to ours regarded this Earth with envious eyes. And slowly and surely, they drew their plans against us.
Go. That's Eve of the War from War of the Worlds, of course.
Yes.
And that's Jeff Wayne, Richard Burton.
Jeff Wayne was the composer and the writer of the War of the Worlds.
He was, yes.
And I think if you turn it up, we should have him on the telephone now.
Hello, can you hear us there?
I can hear everybody. Hello.
Oh, fabulous.
Hiya.
Okay, hello, Nathan.
Hello, how do you do?
I'm good, thanks.
I suppose the main thing that we're all probably wondering, me and Seb and myself, is what inspired you to write a musical about War of the Worlds? What drew you to the story?
Well, this takes us back to just past the mid-1970s, Nathan, and I was composing, arranging, producer for a lot of media, songs and things, and I started producing for my what was then a fledgling record label of mine, and I just signed David Essex. And David wrote pretty much all of his own material. So for a chunk of my working career, I was servicing all of his songs as his producer and arranger, and then I was touring with him as his musical director. And my dad, in fact, reminded me during that period, he said, hey, you know, don't forget that as part of your goals as a composer, you wanted to try to find a big story that you'd fall in love with, feel very passionate about. And don't forget that. And I remembered exactly that as I was touring with David, and suddenly I get this book, H.G. Wells' The War of the Worlds, from my dad, as one of the books we were reading during that period, from all different genres, not just science fiction. Hmm. But when you're out on tour, you know, you do sometimes do a lot of traveling, you have a lot of time on your hands if you wish to read, and I read this book of H.G. Wells's, and I wasn't familiar with it at all, but it was on one read something that just caught me immediately, and from a composing and producing point of view, it was love at first read, I guess.
Hi, Jeff. I've got a question about... I've got the, you know, the 7-CD collector's edition that came out a few years ago of your album. There's a song on there that intrigues me, and it's a Lego commercial with Forever Autumn. What can you tell me about that?
Lego?
Well, indeed. There's a song in The War of the Worlds that's become a very big hit for us, and it works beautifully in the story of the musical version of The War of the Worlds. But it life started, or a small section of it, of Forever Autumn, started as a composition that I did for Lego Toys. And it just happened that at some point, you know, the public can write in saying, what's that piece of music? And something takes off from it. And it was just one of those that did, and I became conscious of that. And at the point when I was writing The War of the Worlds, there was a point in the story when our journalist, portrayed by Richard Burton as this very large 11-foot high floating hologram above the stage, but in the story he's trying to come to London to take his fiancée Carrie and her father out of the clutches of the Martians as this invasion is expanding, and he arrives at their house in London to discover they're not there. And there's a key hook in the lyric that talks about, because you're not here. And I kept thinking of this song, Forever Autumn, that we expanded from the original 30-second commercial that eventually became what Forever Autumn was within The War of the Worlds. So the reality is it did start off life as a commercial for Lego Toys and grew into this this full song.
Mm. That is my favourite from the show, I think. Is that and Thunderchild? I think Thunderchild's a close second.
All right, well, thanks very much.
The lyrics of the tripods wading up the Thames, cutting through bridges as though they were paper, that's one of my favourites.
I've got to ask you about the arena tours, Jeff. I mean, I've never actually seen the arena tour. I keep missing it. How does that work on a stage? How do they stage that to make it the spectacle that everyone talks about?
Well, it goes back to the very first touring. This is our fourth year of touring now. We started in 2006, and each production keeps growing in ingredients and technologies, but essentially it's a marriage between live performance of musicians on stage. I'm conducting, it's about 50 musicians or so, plus performers who are playing the characters that were first heard on the original album.
Yeah.
But set against that are these various technologies that touch on holography, special effects. There's even a levitation illusion.
Oh, fabulous.
When I saw it, I think it was the 2007 I saw it.
Yeah, we saw the original.
It wasn't in that one. It was only in from last tour in 2009. And it comes from a very long sequence called The Spirit of Man, which is between the role of Beth, who's married to a parson named Nathaniel. And it's sort of a duet between the belief of hope and hopelessness, sanity and insanity. And it goes back and forth between them, but Beth perishes at the very end. A cylinder from Mars lands on a house she's taking shelter in, trying to get Parson Nathaniel, her husband, to join her in taking the shelter. But once the cylinder lands, she perishes, and we suddenly see her prone body on the stage, and her spirit rises from it.
Oh, wow.
Well, for the first three tours, that's spirit was reflected by a light rising to heaven, and although we hear her voice, because she's still calling out as a spirit to Nathaniel, he can't see her, but he can hear her. But from 2009, it turned into, for the first time in any arena that we were told, an illusion where, in full view of the audience, her spiritual body levitates to the full height of the stage to the lighting rig. Very compelling stuff. This tour, we've improved it even further. It's got a little more sort of mystery about it.
Fantastic.
It will be a first, that, as well. My background's actually from special effects and staging, and you've really intrigued me now with all this talk of special effects and then levitation as well. They're like my two big things in theatre. One's to fly across the stage, and the other's to go down the trapdoor.
To be incinerated by a tripod.
Well, if you see it, and we can convince you that it's really happening before your very eyes, then we've done a good job. But we do work with people that are specialists from that world, and arenas are quite different than, and you may know this yourself, you know, from, say, TV or very small theaters by comparison, because sight lines are very tricky for an audience to be sitting on, say, the sides of an arena, and obviously not seeing things that wouldn't be seen.
Yeah, it's one of the hardest effects to stage in any theater, full stop. But I mean, when is it a full surround? Is it a full round audience with the arena tours?
We perform always at one end.
Right.
So we cut off one end of whatever arena we're playing. The thing that makes this sort of marriage of technology and live performance tricky is that, as you can appreciate, every arena, no matter where we've played, whatever country, they're different in size and shape and depth and height. And we go up to, so far, the biggest ones we played in the O2, a couple in Australia, which are around 20,000 seats. But we also play a few in, say, in Cardiff and Brighton that are around 4,500 to 5,000. So you have to sort of be able to design the shows almost like an accordion to expand and contract. Production, we've got even more new ingredients, so I'm keeping my fingers crossed, because we start rehearsals in about 10 days, and that's when we'll really know if it all works.
I was just looking at the blurb that we've got about this current tour, and it mentioning some of the people that you've got working with it. You've got Jason Donovan, Liz McLarnon from Atomic Kitten, Ridian, who's playing Parson Nathaniel, and from the original concept album, you've got Justin Hayward as well.
And Chris Thompson.
So a really stellar cast coming to Manchester in December for it.
Justin and Chris were on the original double album, and they've been on every tour with me, whereas the other parts, we seem to have, from tour to tour, always worked with new people, which is a nice combination, but we're very pleased that everybody that's on board is with us, because they've all worked with me in my studio. I live in Hertfordshire, and everybody who's ever come in to try a role out, we go through it to sort of like master standard to convince them they're right for the role, and as well as to convince our team that it works for us. So it's a good way of starting off, and so we know already how they're going to sound and act and sing, and we're very excited about it.
Oh, fabulous. I think so.
Yeah, I had a question about the CGI that's behind the tripod that you've got on stage, which tells a story. Read somewhere that there was once talks of you trying to produce that as a full film. Was that true, or is that a myth I've heard?
No, it's absolutely correct. In fact, we had spent somewhere around 15 to 18 months before the first tour came around, starting on that animated feature film set to my musical version. And in fact, it was because of that pre-production work that the tours benefited from having, we have a 100-foot wide screen, it's about 20, 25 feet tall, and for the full two and a quarter hours of the length of the show, this animated film runs in perfect synchronization with the live performance and all the other technologies. Had we not spent all that pre-production time on our film, the tour would never have benefited from it because of the amount of time it takes to work with CGI.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And interestingly enough, after 3 years, we started all over again for this production with almost entirely new animation. And as with all technologies, you know, things do move on. So the mood of this next version of the animation, it's darker in mood, it's a bit scarier in places.
Right.
And again, it's another, for us, a brand new ingredient because we've replaced the previous animation.
Mm. When the show gets into to an arena, does it take a long time to set the stage up?
We have to be able to go from one city on one night and be performing the next evening in another. So takes a very large crew who are highly skilled in that endeavor, you know, in terms of rigging it and de-rigging it in time. There are places that we play multiple shows, so for them it's a bit of a holiday because they don't have to, you know, get to the next city for 2 or 3 days because we're playing 2 or 3 shows in a given city. But a number of the shows we are in one city one night, performing the next. And in fact, when the audience is leaving, if they were to turn around, they'd see it being de-rigged in full view of them. It's almost like having a second show. It's really fascinating to watch. On the very first tour, I had to come out and meet some friends of mine at the front of house where the sound is being mixed. And I suddenly was aware how extraordinary it is. It's like a circus being, you know, de-rigged in full view of everybody. No curtains, nothing. It's very interesting to watch.
I can imagine. About the tripod itself takes a while to put up and take down.
Yes, I mean, that's the Martian fighting machine. Well, yeah. When you consider it's about, at full extension, it's about 35 feet tall, and it comes down hidden from the lighting rig about half an hour into the story. So its legs extend. It weighs just over 3 tons.
Oh, my good Lord.
It's got bug-like eyes with cameras inside it that scan the audience at different times. And they see themselves up on this giant screen as if they're the next victims of the Martians.
That's a bit eerie.
Next to be vaporized.
Its main weapon is called a heat ray. And up until this tour that we're about to perform, it's always been expressed as sort of like a laser light with smoke.
Yeah.
This time, it's the first time we've been able to convince health and safety that we can use and are using real flame and heat.
Oh, gosh. Fabulous.
Yeah, we only incinerate the first 3 rows of the audience.
Okay, and
it's a small price to pay for a great effect. That's the way I see it.
Well, yeah.
No, so I can imagine what you have to go through with something on that scale.
There's no doubt. I mean, health and safety has really come into the entertainment world. Just in the 4 years we've been touring the War of the Worlds, I've seen, you know, the fact that you have to have a representative come down, write a full report, explain and demonstrate why even the smallest thing is safe.
Mm-hmm.
The rigging, for example, of our fighting machine, as just one example, has to be double rigged in the sense that if one motor fails, another one kicks in, and anything that could create even the tiniest amount of harm to not just the audience but performers on stage, when you consider there's, as I was saying earlier, 50 musicians, performers on stage, me on my podium, I'm right underneath it as this 3-ton device is landing. It's quite a formidable beast. It covers a large chunk of the stage when it lands. So even on our first rehearsals with the whole production of performers and musicians, we do a demonstration to show exactly where it lands. It's a tripodian device, as you rightly said. So it's got 3 legs, which are precisely marked out on the stage, so no one is supposed to go near it, sit near it, put even a violin case underneath it. It's formidable.
I've just checked ticket availability, and there are still some tickets left for Manchester.
Oh, although, thank goodness for that.
I think it must be selling out quite fast, though, Jeff, because there's only a couple of areas left in the arena.
That's good.
That's interesting to know. I didn't know that. It's not something I follow all that closely. I just have been told, you know, every month or so how well it's been doing. There's been 4 shows added in the UK, a couple in Holland, because we actually start in Holland and then go to Belgium in November. Before we hit Dublin and Belfast, and then we come all through 11 cities of the UK. So we're very excited because it does seem to be doing really well, and most importantly, I'd like to think that it's, you know, the value and the enjoyment factor is what the people is coming are coming to see and to hear, and that's the biggest reward for all of us.
Are there any plans to either revitalise or make a tour or something of your other album, Spartacus?
Oh, yes.
Which had Catherine Zeta-Jones in.
It's a funny thing you asked that, because our promoters have asked me to consider doing that. It's a very visual piece.
Oh, I think you should.
Yeah.
And thank you. Thank you for saying that. I would love to revisit it, but it's been quite an unexpected long journey with the War of the Worlds since we started performing it. And every time I'm asked, just as we're about to start a tour, what do you got planned for after the tour? And I say, I've got a new project, whatever it might be, or I'm going to revisit Spartacus for an arena type show. We've been asked to do another tour virtually as we're completing that tour. So I've stopped saying what I'm going to do after this current tour, because we've just been booked to do another one in other countries outside of the UK at the end of next year.
Right. Cool.
So I can't predict exactly, but I would love to. It, you know, it's a true story, and it took me 3 years to research it. It's a very passionate story. It's, you know, about slave over master over slave. There's a lot of relevance in today's world of invasions and all the things that we live in a real world of today, so I'd love to see it come to life.
Yeah, so would I.
I think we all would. We're going to have to move on, but can I just say, first of all, thank you so much for joining us, Jeff. It really is a privilege for all of us. We're all sat here in awe thinking, how long can we keep talking before you get bored of us?
Not at all. Thanks for having me on your program. It's
thank you
very
much.
Everybody.
So there we go. That's the fabulous Jeff Wayne, composer and writer of The War of
and
the
conductor
Worlds.
And conductor of the UK tour. And this next recording is from the 2009 tour, and it was released as a single, and it's
Jennifer Ellison.
Yep, and Shannon Knoll singing The Spirit of Man, originally by Julie Covington and Phil Lynam.
No. There must be more to life. There has to be a way that we can restore to life the light that we have lost.
So there we go, Spirit of Man, 2009 single version, Shannon Knoll and Jennifer Ellison from... Jennifer Ellison?
That's my scouse there.
It's better than your Russian.
Oh, quite. I just thought of an interesting coincidence.
Yeah.
My name's Nathan.
Yeah.
And my sister's called Elizabeth. Beth and Nathaniel.
My
dad's a big fan of War of the Worlds. I think that he lied to me.
Oh, you're plugging for a gig, aren't you?
He lied to me. I'm not named after John Wayne. I'm named after a character out of a Jeff Wayne musical.
Man gets hit by Richard Burton's boot.
That's true.
And then I hit him in the
magnet. And a collector picks up Beth and throws her in a basket to...
Yeah.
If you do want to find out more details on the tour or get tickets, you can get them from www.thewaroftheworlds.com.